Jamie Williamson, retired Special Forces Colonel on the America Out Loud Radio Network. You're listening to OPSEC Radio. Folks, the premise of OPSEC Radio is keeping America safe. OPSEC is comprised of retired members of the Special Operations community and also of the intelligence community, which includes most of the three-letter agencies, to include the FBI. Keeping America safe is not always about foreign policy, but we also have domestic threats. I want to welcome our sponsor, Liberty Ammunition, kind enough to sponsor this show, a great defender of the Second Amendment and producers of quality ammunition made in the United States. Please go to www.libertyammunition.com. They've set up a special discount, a 15% discount for OPSEC listeners. So buy your bullets online. Enter the promotional code OPSEC15 at checkout. And please check out their, make high quality ammunition. It's lightweight, high penetration, and it's green ammunition. With me today is Bob Hamer, Marine Corps veteran and veteran 26 years with the FBI, most of it undercover. You've got a new book out, and you've got a number of books, which I didn't realize, but first let me welcome you and thank you for your service. We all serve, and a lot of our federal law enforcement agencies often get overlooked when we talk about the intelligence community. It's not just the military side, but the FBI in particular plays a crucial role. And you've got a very fascinating career, and I'd like you to share it with our listeners and tell us about some of the operations and how you got in from being a special agent into the whole undercover role.
But yeah, I appreciate that. Thanks. Yeah, I spent 4 years on active duty in the Marine Corps, and since we're among friends here, I was a judge advocate. I was a lawyer, so I often laughed that the Marines didn't consider me a Marine and the lawyers didn't consider me a lawyer. But what I did learn was that I hated being in the courtroom. I hated being an attorney, and I was looking for something more exciting. I do believe that the Marine Corps developed in me that warrior ethos, and I carried that into the courtroom, but I wanted to carry it beyond, and I was looking for something that was a heck of a lot more exciting than the courtroom. Fortunately for me, the FBI was looking for lawyers, and I applied and was able to get in, then spent 26 years in the Bureau. Many of those years were undercover. I think I was just always looking for something exciting, and to me, undercover work was exciting. It was more exciting than just conducting interviews and investigations. As I'm sure most of your listeners are aware, I mean, there basically are two types of investigations. You either have the reactive or the proactive. So a lot of the work in the FBI was reactive, where you have someone's been kidnapped or the bank's been robbed, and now it's up to you to recover the child or to find out who robbed the bank. But a lot of what we did, a big emphasis in the Bureau, was proactive. So we identified a criminal problem and then went after it and tried to figure out who was conducting the criminal problem or what crimes a particular group was committing. So throughout my career in an undercover capacity, I targeted mob guys, Russian organized crime figures, drug dealers, a few white-collar criminals. I actually infiltrated a group called NAMBLA, which is the North American Man-Boy Love Association. It was a group of men who were sexually attracted to little boys. I will say it was my most difficult undercover case, not because it wasn't nearly as dangerous as most of my cases. I mean, I've shot people, I've been shot at, but NAMBLA, it was so disgusting to me and so diametrically opposed to anything that I believed in. It was kind of hard for me to wrap my mind around being a pedophile, yeah, someone that was sexually attracted to children.
Get into a character and live that cover.
It was tough. I mean, I know we want to talk more about domestic security and national defense and all of that, but just as an example, obviously, when you get hired as a hitman, when you're posing as a contract killer, the people that are hiring you are more concerned with whether you can actually pull the trigger and get the job done. And they really don't care whether you like NFL football or the ballet, just as long as they believe you're capable of performing. In NAMBLA, it was a completely different mindset. As an example, one of the people that we eventually convicted was a dentist. He had taped a Sylvan Learning commercial. Now, you and I may have taped that commercial because we wanted to get the mailing address and the phone number, and we thought it would be great for our kids or our grandchildren to learn to read better or do their math. He did it because he was in love with a little boy, and he just played this Sylvan Learning commercial over and over again because of his love for the little boy. One of their favorite movies was Lord of the Flies, not because of some cinematic creation, but because it was a bunch of little boys running around in their underwear. So as an undercover agent, I had to think like these guys. I had to see things completely differently than what I did in my normal life. So that was a difficult assignment for me. And ironic, because I know it's kind of the case we want to get into. At the same time that I was undercover in NAMBLA, I got involved in a case called Operation Smoking Dragons, and we can talk about that. I actually was working three undercover cases at the same time. I like to say that toward the end of my career, I got all the IOU assignments on the West Coast. So if they were looking for somebody that was impotent, old, or ugly, they would call me, and I was working the cases. So I was working a Vietnamese gang case. Now you have to picture this. At the time, I was about a 55-year-old white guy that was always handicapped. I often used an arm crutch like House did in the TV series. So I would use an arm crutch. I'm 55 years old. Eventually, we had targeted this Vietnamese gang. I stumbled into their clubhouse, and by the time we were done, I was purchasing crystal meth and ecstasy from these Vietnamese gang members. On the other days of the week, I'm working NAMBLA, and then I get involved in a case called Operation Smoking Dragon.
You know, and any of those roles are challenging unto themselves, yet to balance three separate roles and identities at the same time, that's incredible, Bob.
Well, I kept the same backstory in all of these cases, and the key is you've got to lie, but you can't lie too much. You don't want to get caught in the little lies, so you tell as much of the truth as you can, at least so you can keep your story straight. I mean, if I'm going to get killed undercover, I want to get killed because of a major problem, not because I happen to say I'm single and then I get confused and I mention. Mention my wife and kids back home, and then it said, "Wait a minute, I thought you said you were single." So I always tried to stick to the truth, but in this particular instance, I always kept the same backstory, which wasn't true. But my grandfather had died. He left me with a pretty sizable trust account. I managed the stock funds within that trust account. I was a pretty savvy investor. And as a result of that, I had four or five clients throughout the United States that I managed their money, and I took a percentage of new profit. So this I was not a licensed broker, so there's no way they could check up on me with backstopping, or I didn't need backstopping to prove that I was a licensed broker. But it allowed for me to play a more high roller type of position and had income available to me either through savvy investing or wise real estate or my criminal deeds. So I kept that backstory. So I'm a white guy that has a handicap and have money available, and I own some real estate, which is how we played into this whole Operation Smoking Dragon. The FBI was very concerned with what was happening in our ports. the West Coast. I was based out of L.A. Long Beach and Los Angeles are two of the largest ports in the world, and we had a concern about what was coming into the ports. We also knew from intelligence, both from your intelligence community, from the FBI, from the CIA, and other agencies, that a lot of counterfeit goods were coming into the United States, particularly counterfeit cigarettes. And these counterfeit cigarettes were filtering down to mom-and-pop grocery stores, many of which were owned by Middle Easterners, and some of those people were using the proceeds from counterfeit cigarettes to finance terrorism overseas, Hamas, Hezbollah, and other terrorist organizations. So the FBI kind of looked at this as a snake, and we were going to go after the head of the snake, the people that were bringing in the counterfeit goods and the counterfeit cigarettes in particular, and then the tail of the snake, the mom-and-pop grocery stores that were distributing these counterfeit cigarettes and using those proceeds to finance terrorism. I was fortunate because I got to play the head of the snake, and we set up a role. Somewhat ironic, we had an informant. I met him one or two times. Actually, I met him once, and then he made the introduction. I couldn't even pick him out of a lineup anymore, but he had told my case agent that they had more faith in older Caucasian males than they did with members of the Asian community. So we had identified the Chinese American who was the largest importer of counterfeit cigarettes on the West Coast. I get introduced to him. My story is that I've got a warehouse in Pomona, California, that he can store his cigarettes in my warehouse. I have access to long-haul truck drivers, so I can get his cigarettes distributed throughout the country. And maybe once a month, if all my employees line up, if the people that are working at the port, if they're working all on the same day and I pay enough bribes, I can get their containers of cigarettes through the past customs without the cigarettes being seized. Now, they were bringing in a ton of cigarettes without my help, but we kind of threw that in too so that maybe once a month I could bring in a container of cigarettes.
So we're talking a Ro-Ro shipping container full. So that's quite a few.
Yeah. We were talking 40-foot shipping containers that contained well over a million counterfeit cigarettes. Now, these were the most popular brand were the Marlboro Reds. The packaging was identical. If I held up a pack of Marlboro cigarettes that was made in the United States compared to the ones made in China and North Korea, we knew that the counterfeit cigarettes were coming out of both countries. You couldn't tell the difference. The packaging was identical. The only real difference was that cigarettes made in the United States used Virginia, Kentucky, North Carolina tobacco, and the cigarettes coming out of North Korea and China were used Asian tobacco. So that I'm not a smoker, but the people that would smoke could say they could really tell the difference.
Yeah, I was at the time when I was in China, and I thought, God, if everybody had a cell phone in one hand and a cigarette in the other. And I smoked Marlboro Reds, and of course they tasted like shit, and they were cheap. But I was like, these can't possibly be Virginia tobacco. And this was in the late 80s.
Well, that was what was amazing about this investigation from our perspective, that a pack of cigarettes, back when I was working on the West Coast, a pack of cigarettes was going for $4 or $5 a pack. On the East Coast, they were, and especially in New York City, they were going for $9, $10, $11 a pack. Well, they were getting entire cartons that would have 10 packs to a carton, and those a carton of counterfeit cigarettes, they were picking up for $7, $8 a carton. So the proceeds from counterfeit cigarettes was as great, if not greater, than a lot of the drug transactions, and there were very few law enforcement authorities that were looking at counterfeit cigarettes. So it made all the sense in the world for these guys to to focus most of their criminal activity into the counterfeit cigarettes because of the profits.
Yeah, it's just economically more feasible.
So what we did, I got introduced to the guy. He bought my act. It took about a month. Within 3 weeks to a month, he contacted me, and they had a container of cigarettes that he wanted delivered to the West Coast. So we had them deliver the cigarettes to our warehouse in Pomona. Then we were supposed to transport this container of cigarettes back to where Russian mob guys had a place, and then they were going to take the cigarettes into New York City. So the very first container, this 40-foot container of Marlboro Reds, we had an undercover truck driver that got the cigarettes back there. I went back to Allentown, met with five Russian mob guys, two of whom had been identified as previous Russian intelligence agents, and I met with them. We delivered the cigarettes. They took me to a house that the FBI wasn't aware of. I sat there in the house and watched these guys take the take counterfeit tax stamps. I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with a pack of cigarettes has a tax stamp on it to prove that they paid the tax in the local jurisdiction. So I watched them affix counterfeit New York tax stamps to these packs of Marlboro cigarettes and then left. So everything, they were pleased with me that I was able to deliver the container. Nothing happened. Nobody was arrested. They took me out to this little house that they had. It's kind of a safe house where they were putting on the tax stamps on the cigarettes. And then I came back to the West Coast. My guy on the West Coast was very pleased with me because the cigarettes had been delivered, nothing had happened, and now I'm the golden boy, and began to meet more people within this organization, and that's when the case really began to take off.
Wow, that's fascinating. What was the time frame of this, Bob?
This was in 2002 when we started the, in September 2002 when we started the investigation, and then eventually we took it down in August of 2005. So I was undercover for almost 3 years in this operation. What made it interesting was once we were able to successfully deliver that container and nothing happened and they paid me for the services, then they believed in me and started using me, introduced me to a couple more of their associates. I ended up meeting the girlfriend of the top exporter of counterfeit cigarettes out of China. He had been in the United States. There was a warrant out for his arrest, so he fled to China and now was working out of China, setting up the deliveries into the United States. So we've met the top importer on the West Coast, the girlfriend of one of the top exporters out of China, and then I began meeting more and more people because we would have the bad guys were coming to the warehouse and picking up master cases of the cigarettes, not always taking the entire container, but they might take 10, 15, 20 master cases of the cigarettes. They would leave the warehouse. We were working with locals and other authorities, so we might have them pull the truck over for a taillight violation 10 miles down the road, and lo and behold, they would seize the truck, and there's the counterfeit cigarettes, so they'd seize the cigarettes. We might help them deliver it to another warehouse, and then we'd wait a couple days. Customs would get involved and come in and seize the cigarettes out of their new warehouse. So we're doing this now, and it's never coming back on me. So for 3 years, we're starting it never comes back on me, but we're identifying the larger scope of this conspiracy and following the cigarettes and seeing the trail and identifying what's going on with this whole operation. But it goes well. Within about a month of this first delivery, make that back to the East Coast, the Russian mob guys call me, and now they've got some stolen cars and want to know if I want cars that they've stolen off the ports of Newark. So I fly back there, meet with them. We buy a couple stolen cars from them, some BMWs that they've taken. I introduce them to another undercover agent on the East Coast that's working a similar operation. So we've got an operation on the East Coast and the West Coast. The girlfriend on the West Coast of the top exporter of counterfeit cigarettes, one day, just out of the blue, brings me 500 hits of ecstasy. Now, in my undercover career, I probably purchased $20, $30 million worth of heroin and cocaine, and I'd never seen ecstasy before. I like to teach the younger agents that if you are stupid, play stupid. And it was just like, hey, what is this? I don't know what this is. So she explains the whole thing to me. This is made in Amsterdam. We bring it into Montreal. We smuggle it across the border. It's a party drug. Well, you know, how do you ingest it, Jenny? And she explains to me how you ingest it. And essentially, I say, well, let me check. One of my clients owns a bar down in New Orleans. Let me see if he wants ecstasy. So I get on the phone and call my case agent, and he says, yeah, let's buy some ecstasy. So we start buying ecstasy. A couple days later, she comes back with crystal meth. And again, the same thing. You know, it's more of a party drug, so if your people are doing ecstasy, they're going to want to do crystal meth. So now we've expanded beyond counterfeit cigarettes and stolen cars, but we're going into ecstasy and crystal meth. At one point, and you know, it's not like the movies, as you well know in your career, but I convinced Jenny that, look, I didn't want her to get in trouble with the drugs, because I didn't want Michael, her boyfriend over in China, to get mad at me if she gets popped for drugs. So I convinced her to introduce me to her drug connection here in the United States. And I just told her, look, I'll pay you a piece of everything I do. So I'm not going to cut you out. I just want to keep you from being caught in the middle of this. So every time I do a deal with John, I'll give you a piece of the action. She bought off on that and introduced me to her connection. Eventually, we start getting multi quantities of crystal meth, and at one point I buy 2 kilos of crystal meth. I actually traded my services. I didn't pay cash for it, but traded my warehouse, the use of my warehouse,
right,
for 2 kilos of crystal meth, which the DEA lab in National City said it was the highest quality crystal meth they'd ever analyzed. And John, our subject, tells us this was made on a Chinese military base. So we were pleased with the quantity of drugs and the fact that he had identified this as coming from a Chinese military base.
We are one of the fastest growing podcast and talk radio networks in the world. You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. It's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. We stand proudly with the men and women who serve in our armed forces and our law enforcement heroes. Thank you for being part of our family. And we'll see you back at AmericaOutLoud.com.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa. Award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
When I was in Iraq, we found there was a lot of ecstasy that was coming in from Iran. And you're talking about how one thing leads to another. There was all kinds of counterfeit stuff. Counterfeit Gucci sunglasses and North Face jackets and, you know, all this stuff was feeding into the Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, Hamas, and the tentacles were just tremendous.
Yeah, we ended up, I mean, we expanded beyond the cigarettes, and I'll tell you how much further we expanded, but we went beyond the cigarettes to the counterfeit clothing, to even counterfeit postage stamps. Back then, this was a little before they introduced the Forever stamp, mm-hmm. but they were counterfeiting 37-cent postage stamps, and we had the largest seizure of counterfeit postage stamps. Now, you and I would stop to think, what's the profit in 37 cents? You know, but they were coming in the 100 roll stamps in 100 rolls, 100 stamps to a roll. It had the barcode on. It looked like the same thing if you'd go to the post office and buy it. And we had 15 master cases of these of counterfeit postage stamps in these 15 master cases. So there were millions of these 37-cent stamp counterfeit stamps. So then we got involved in Viagra. They were manufacturing counterfeit Viagra, literally sending it to the pharmaceutical houses in Canada for the online pharmaceuticals. We were picking up some of that. And I don't mean this wasn't just the little blue pills. This was the pills in the pharmaceutical bottles with all of the paperwork to make it look like the same thing that you would find if you went into a CVS or a Walgreens behind the counter at the pharmacy where the pharmacist picks out the pills from the large bottles. So they were involved in so many different counterfeit goods.
I guess there's a stiff sentence for that. Sorry, couldn't
Well, it was interesting. At one point, I told one of our guys, I said, you know, your idea of copyright means right to copy. And he says, yeah. He says, you know, you bring me whatever you have. We make copy for you. I mean, that was just it. It was sort of the reverse engineering of many very simple things.
I've been told that so much of the Chinese technological advances come from stolen technology from the United States, either blueprints, plans, or the actual finished product that's reverse engineered.
Yeah, no, I think we think so much of espionage as being a disclosure of military secrets, but a lot of this is industrial espionage where they get a hold of our latest technology and either reverse engineer it or get the blueprints or the plans and have an understanding of it and just manufacture it over there. So as you are aware, and probably many of your listeners, North Korea counterfeits our $100 bill. It's called the Supernote. It's a near perfect replica of the $100 bill. We, at that point, I was tasked by the Bureau and my case agent to see if I couldn't get these super notes. We wanted to prove that in fact North Korea was doing this. I think they had enough intelligence, but they didn't have direct knowledge of all this. And because of the people that I was associated with on the Asians that I was dealing with, that we thought we might be able to do this. So I make up a story that doesn't really sound plausible if you think about it, but in essence, every time I would do a criminal deal with these guys, I would open an escrow account and tell them that if in fact I don't get your container through customs, I will pay you this this money. You know, it's kind of an insurance that I'll pay, that I can guarantee I can get it through customs. And if I don't, I will, this money will be transferred over to your account. So I'm telling them that I've got money tied up in safety deposit boxes. I have $250,000 in one box, $500,000 in another. And this is all real money, which, because I'm a savvy investor, I could make more money by investing this money. So I need good quality counterfeit money. And I couldn't print a note, but I tell them that I want good quality counterfeit money. I'm dealing with about five different organizations now underneath this criminal umbrella. So I got one guy brings me a $100 bill, and I give it to my case agent, who gives it to Secret Service, and they said, "Oh no, this is made in Colombia. We've already seen this one." Next bill they bring, the Secret Service says, "No, this is made in Macau. We've already seen this." The next bill we bring, they bring me, Secret Service says, "Oh, we've never seen this one before, but this is not the supernote." Finally, they brought me two supernotes. And two different guys brought me two different supernotes. So now we begin negotiation for the purchase of the supernote. It was 35 cents on the dollar. I probably should back up. They bring me these, both these guys bring me these bills telling me that the cost is 35 cents on the dollar. The Secret Service analyst in LA said that the money was real. Came back down to me through my case agent that this money was real. And I said, "Let me tell you, if this is real money, and they're willing to sell this to me at 35 cents on a dollar, I'm mortgaging my house, and I will buy as much as I possibly can." And I said, "You might want to have this checked back in D.C. Well, they sent the money back to D.C., and the word quickly came back that, yes, this was the supernote. And what had originally happened was, as they were counterfeiting this money, every time there was a discrepancy, or they would... the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, Treasury Department, Secret Service would put out to the merchants and the banks that, you know, Richard Nixon is not on the $100 bill. Well, North Korea then would modify their plates. So it was getting to the point where their plates were near perfect. There were three top secret marks that headquarters, Secret Service, had not even disclosed to the analysts out in the field, because every time they make disclosures, it was somehow getting discovered. Yeah. And they didn't want North Korea correcting it. So there were three top secret marks on the bills, and came back and said, "Yes, this is the supernote." So I began getting involved with a couple different people on that. We eventually, we make our first initial purchase of one. It was $350,000 for this $1 million. By now, I've made close to $1 million from the bad guys for all the different services that we're doing, for the cigarettes that I'm storing and delivering, which most of them aren't even getting through because we're ripping them off and they don't realize it. And we're using, actually, the bad guys are paying for their own investigation. So we pay the $350,000 to buy the $1 million. We get the first million. It comes back. It was the largest seizure that the Bureau had ever done with the supernote. But we have one meeting. It's a long story that I won't get into, but in essence, the Bureau kind of hung my fanny out to dry, and it took me... What should have been done in a couple days took me 2 weeks by the time I got all the approvals from headquarters, because they were smoking something back there. Yeah. And we're in the Ritz-Carlton, and the one guy tells me that, he says, "You know, you never do this to me again. You never do this. You tell me, I thought your word was good. You say you have money in 3 days, you not have it. It take 2 weeks. You get us all killed. You don't understand. This money is made by North Korea, and it's distributed through the Russian embassy in Beijing. If you don't trust me, you can come with me, and we go in and we get the money there. But, you know, you never hang me out like this again." So here we have confirmation, you know, from our people that yes, it's made in North Korea. It's being distributed through the Russian embassy in China, and we do another buy. Eventually, as we get ready to take down this case, we one of the representatives on the Supernote comes in, flies in from overseas, meets me, and we negotiate where I'm going to be the exclusive distributor of the Supernote in the United States, where they're going to give me $40 million a year to launder.
That's a great salary.
Yeah, and I didn't keep any samples either, which was a mistake. But one of the guys that we convicted had laundered nearly $1 million of these Supernotes through the slot machines of Las Vegas.
And, now, were these the new Big Ben head with the watermark?
No, these were the bills that were made in 1996, new bills came out in 96. And now, as a result of this case and other cases, but the newest bills that we have today that you're seeing on the market, that's to combat the North Korean counterfeiting our bills. When the new bills came out in 96, I was undercover at the racetrack doing a race fixing investigation, and all the gamblers were all excited about the new $100 bill, and I certainly wasn't a counterfeit expert, and I just assumed, you know, when we're talking counterfeit, we're talking about some guy that's Xeroxing off $100 bills on his Xerox machine and cutting them up and trying to pass them. I didn't realize that there were governments involved. It's an act of war to counterfeit nation's currency.
That's the regime.
So that 96 bill, the bill that came out in 96, that was supposed to combat the previous efforts to counterfeit the bills, and they thought they had all these security devices in place that would prevent that bill from being counterfeited. And what we were getting from North Korea, in the bills we were getting had serial numbers and for 2003, 2004, right in that period of time. But those were supposed to be counterfeit proof, and they were doing a great job of counterfeiting those.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine the damage that goes on. It's so subtle. We found, you know, when I was in Iraq, I was running all the interpreters, and it was such a tremendous source of street intelligence where I kind of inadvertently became the intelligence broker. I had left my contract position and gone on active duty at the behest of Special Operations Command and the DASD counter drug, but I was working for the DODIG, who was a Navy Admiral reservist that happened to work for the CIA in his full-time job. But I mean, it was crazy, but it gave me top cover for conflict of interest because I worked for the DODIG. But we blew a hole in the wall and to breach this compound, and the wall was hollow and it was full of money. There were burning notes scattered around everywhere, and you know, it's trying to restrain the soldiers, and you know, these things got turned over to Treasury, and there was a huge and this was coming, it was traced to Iran, and there was a lot of stuff coming in from Iran because the borders were so porous at that point. But
you know, Jamie, I would be curious on those bills. In my negotiations, they talked about a Middle Eastern guy that was buying $50 million at a time of the North Korean supernotes. And I've never heard whether those counterfeit bills that they were finding in Iran were actually manufactured in, or finding in Iraq, were those manufactured in Iran, or were these the North Korean supernotes? Do you know the answer to that?
I don't. I know they tracked them, that they had come from Iran, but I don't know, you know, once they had tracked down the point of origin. We had Secret Service liaison, but I wasn't made privy to where the origin of those notes were.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I never heard that either, but I often wondered when I heard about Saddam Hussein and the large caches of money that they were finding, if in fact that wasn't just counterfeit currency and stuff being manufactured in North Korea. And who knows, maybe Iran is making just as quality $100 bills as what North Korea was doing. But this, you're right, because for North Korea, they were using these counterfeit bills. I mean, that was their nuclear technology for their whole criminal enterprise and regime, because they were paying their spies, they were using their money, whatever they were bringing in, they were paying for it with $100 bills, with U.S. currency.
Yeah, probably all the Pakistani scientists, physicists got paid off in counterfeit greenbacks.
Yeah, they were getting paid in cash.
It amazed me, the web of criminal activity and how it was all linked together. And, you know, this was all the byproduct of the hunt for Saddam's sons, Uday and Qusay. We were hitting different targets, and we found all kinds of things, you know, from pornography, counterfeit, like the clothing and the fashion items and the coach bags, and then perfume that, you know, you just couldn't get it. I don't know whether it was counterfeit or not, but, you know, there was a demand for it. But it was all linked to the terror network.
Some of the clothing they were bringing in, one of the things they had, they bringing in Dolce and Gabbana jeans that were counterfeit, and I actually still have a pair of them. But they were made in China. They have the label that says that it's made in Italy, and then they have attached to the jeans a certificate of authenticity, which they counterfeited as well.
Mm-hmm.
And those jeans in the finest boutiques in on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills were going for $150 to $200 a pair. And I paid $8 for my pair of jeans that has the official certificate of authenticity saying that it's made in Italy. So
nice profit margin there.
Yeah, no, tremendous. And most law enforcement agencies aren't looking at that. I mean, a lot of this stuff is taken care of by private investigators within the fashion industry or the cigarette industry or whatever.
Yeah, one of a colleague of mine runs a private investigation company. They do a lot of fraud internationally. You know, from Russia, there was, you know, rock gut vodka being put into bottles and slapping a Stoli label on it and, you know, selling it at premium prices.
Sure.
But it damages, it's not just economic, but it damages the brand. And that's so much of their work globally is brand protection. So what was like one of the worst experiences? You were saying that, you know, you got hung out to dry because of some bureaucratic decisions in the bureau. What were, you know, a time or two where you were really in a precarious position when you were undercover?
Well, I think I always found that the bad guys were easier to deal with than the bureaucracy. I mean, I think there were expectations that the bureaucracy was on your side, and the bad guys, you just didn't expect them. This is actually kind of a silly story, but my very first undercover assignment involved targeting a national jewel thief that was working for the Bonanno crime family. And he was an art thief and a jewel thief, and I got introduced to him, and I was buying stolen art from him. And the bureau at the time, my first office in the FBI was in San Diego. I had come out of Camp Pendleton, which is in northern San Diego County. Mm-hmm. Back then, they had a policy, the Army, the policy changed while I was at the FBI Academy. When I signed on to the FBI, I had finished up at Camp Pendleton. They said, you'll never go back to San Diego. So we sold our home in San Diego. My wife moved in with her parents. We had a little girl at the time. Moved in with her parents in Indiana. I go back to the academy. Halfway through the academy, they say, oh, we've changed our transfer policy. We're sending you back to San Diego. So my first assignment in San Diego, my first undercover assignment, we were targeting this art thief. And so I'm buying stolen art and everything. And it's the Bureau then had the policy that after 6 months in your first office, you got transferred to a top 10 office or a top 12 office, a dirty dozen. And I had already said when I was back at the academy, I said, look, put me in a top 12 office now. And I was from the Midwest. My wife was from the Midwest. I said, I'll go to Detroit. You know, that was one of the offices. I'll go to Detroit or Cleveland, and the military will pay for the transfer. They said, no, you can't do that. You have to go back to San Diego. And it's like, well, that's a no-brainer. If you're making me go to San Diego rather than Detroit or Cleveland, I'll take San Diego. 6 months, I get back there. I've already started this undercover assignment, and they say I'm being transferred to L.A. And there's the SAC in San Diego was trying to fight to keep me there longer because we've already identified three people that we're going to arrest, and it could be more. And so I'm sitting in the car with Dave. Dave knows that I'm married. And he knows that my wife is pregnant, which is true. My wife was pregnant with our second child at the time. And we're sitting in my undercover car, and I actually begin to cry. I mean, they're fake tears, but I tell him, look, Dave, you know my wife is pregnant. She has this condition called inverted placentae, and she's already lost three children, which she's miscarried. There's a specialist back in Indiana that can do this, so I'm going to take her back to Indiana so that we can have this child, because this is so important to me to have this baby. And so I'm not going to be able to run with you every day like we're doing now. And, you know, maybe once a month I can see you or something. But I'm just going, I'm just heading back to the Midwest where my wife can be treated. And I'm crying. I mean, you know, I'm faking these tears. And he leans over and he puts his hand on my knee and he said, have you ever thought about prayer? And like, we've never talked religion. This guy is a thief and everything,
yeah.
A mob guy that's a thief. And he says, I've been studying this religion. It's called Christian Science. And you can call them up over the phone and they can pray for you and they can heal you. And he said, I'm seriously thinking of taking up the religion once I give up stealing. but my point of the story is, that the Bureau didn't care. The Bureau knew my wife was pregnant. The Bureau didn't care that I was involved in this undercover operation. The Bureau didn't care that my wife was pregnant and we were going to have to move and she was going to have to find a new doctor to help with the delivery of the baby. All they saw me as a number and a body that had to report to Los Angeles and couldn't stay in San Diego to at least until the baby was born. But this guy, this bad guy, he was concerned enough about me. Now, granted, he was concerned because I was helping him in his criminal endeavors, but he was concerned enough about me to offer me this opportunity for prayer and healing. And again, the bad guys were always more cooperative than the bureaucracy ever was.
So tell us about the transition into writing and your books, Bob.
We touched upon NAMBLA a little bit. I was so disgusted by that case. It was the NAMBLA case just disgusted me, and the whole boy lover agenda and the idea that these men, the things that they had done to little boys, what they wanted to do to me that they had done, and we ended up arresting eight members of this group's inner circle. But I was so disgusted by that that I wanted to write about that. I had no desire to ever write. I joke that defense counsel used to say I was a great fiction writer, but they were referring to my affidavits that I filed against their clients. But boy lover agenda. So as I was looking to get out of the Bureau, I mean, I was coming up on a mandatory retirement. I met an agent at a Christmas party, and I was just telling him about this case and how I'd really like to write about it. He said, well, write it up. See what you can come up with and get back to me in a couple months. So I started working furiously on the book and sent it to him, and he liked what I had read. And within, I had the manuscript down with about 3 or 4 months and was able to, we thought we were going to get it sold pretty quickly, but there was no publisher wanted to do a whole book on pedophiles, so I ended up throwing in a dozen other cases in which I was an undercover agent. A couple times I was hired as a contract killer, a couple drug cases, the racetrack case that I referred to earlier in the interview. And once we had the dozen around, so the book kind of chronicles that NAMBLA investigation, and then I put in these dozen other cases in between to sort of break up the ick factor with NAMBLA. The book did okay, so then I was approached to write I wrote a couple novels and kind of took out, and I'm on my sixth book now that I've written. I co-authored two books with Ollie North, and now I just finished a book that I wrote for I helped a Vietnam vet who had lost both of his legs and is now an evangelist. And I just finished him finishing up his story. Then I've written three novellas. And it's not the same kind of excitement sitting at a keyboard pounding out words when you're going face to face with bad guys, but keeps me out of trouble. And at least my wife thinks I'm busy when I'm down in the office and I've got the door closed, and usually I'm taking a nap in the chair, but she thinks I'm busy.
So the listeners can find your books on your website at Bob.
Yeah, if you go to bobhamer.net, so that's bobhamer.net. All the books are listed there. They're available through Amazon. I don't think any of the books are in bookstores. So I have The Last Undercover is that first book I mentioned about the NAMBLA, and those are true stories. My two novels are Enemies Among Us and Targets Down, and then I co-wrote two books with Ollie North, Counterfeit Lies and American Heroes on the Home Front, and then this last book that I wrote, I really haven't decided on a title yet, and then I have three novellas that are out that are just smaller novels that are available as ebook downloads.
Well, you're doing a great service by spreading the word, and definitely wanted to give you recognition for that, and I hope that our listeners will go to your website and check out some of your books, your novels, and the factual ones also. So,
well, thank you.
You know, Semper Fi, always an infantryman first, and again...
Well, I think I've told you some interesting FBI stories. I'm still more proud of the fact that I was a Marine than I wasn't much of a Marine, but I appreciate being part of that military brotherhood as much or more so than the law enforcement brotherhood.
It's a special community that only those of us who serve will truly understand, but... Bob, you're a great American. Thank you again for your service, and thank you for joining the show. This is Jamie Williamson on America Out Loud Radio Network. You're listening to OPSEC Radio, sponsored by LibertyAmmunition.com. Please spread the word and check out our website, www.opsec.org, and please tune in again next week.